Live from the University of Texas at Austin, the Liberal Arts Development Studio and the Department of Government present Introduction to American Government with your professors, Darren Shaw and Eric McDaniel.
Hey, it's 105 degrees, and I'm Professor Shaw.
And I'm Professor McDaniel. Welcome to Introduction to American Government, or in the news for Introduction to American Government.
Because it's in the news. Are you sweltering? You all right?
Man, Vegas was 116, so this is a little bit cooler.
Yeah, I was in, where did I go last week? I went to Lynchburg, to Liberty University. It was 92, and it was 10 degrees cooler than it was in Austin.
Yes. So.
All right, so you guys made it. Last in the news segment. You should be pretty familiar with the drill by now. We're going to talk about a couple of topics and ask you guys to write briefly about them, relate them to the broader concepts in the course. We'll try to make some of those connections as we go along, but you know, you may have to pick up some of these threads on your own. Again, the point is to encourage you all to use the kind of theoretical materials and broader materials that we bring to the table in the lecture modules to make sense of what's going on in the news today. And as I said, we'll do a little bit of the heavy lifting for you, but we really want to encourage you guys to spread your wings a little bit and use this stuff to make sense of what's going on. So we've got three things we want to talk about today. One at the state level, which we'll save for last. That's the controversy surrounding the activities of Republican Speaker of the House, Dennis Bonin. And if that doesn't ring a bell, it will soon. We'll explain that. And then we want to talk about two national issues. We want to talk about some changes in the Environmental Protection Act, or at least interpretation of the Environmental Protection Act, that were released Monday of this week by the Trump administration. Then the first issue we're going to start with, though, plays to the broad topic we've discussed in a couple of the modules, media, and in particular, media bias. And there was something that caught my attention this weekend, so this one's kind of my baby, foisting upon Professor McDaniel, although he's quite happy to talk about media coverage, I think. But there was an episode that occurred in the wake of the mass shootings of last week, so the El Paso and the Dayton shootings. Those issues are only going to serve as kind of the background here. We want to focus on the media coverage of those shootings, and in particular, headlines in the New York Times. And I just want to talk real briefly about the notion of media bias and how some aspects of it are really influenced by modern technology, or at least could be. So, what happened? Well, there was a headline in the New York Times that came out after President Trump had a speech concerning the shootings, okay? And there was a controversy that erupted in the Twitterverse about how the New York Times had portrayed President Trump's speech. And then after the sort of uprising in the Twitterverse, the New York Times reacted. We've got a brief video that we're going to show that kind of sets the table so you all have, you know, a good sense of the backdrop here. And Professor McDaniel and I are going to kind of tag team on what we think of this and how it relates to the broader notion of media bias today. So if we could cue that up and bear with us for a sec, we kind of pulled this morning. Hopefully we can strip out all the advertisements. But if we cue that up, I think it'll set the table nicely.
The New York Times receives backlash for headlining President Trump's comments denouncing hate and white supremacy during his speech regarding the recent mass shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, as, quote, "Trump urges unity versus racism." A photograph of the paper's first edition tweeted out by journalist Nate Silver had Twitter users in an uproar, saying the, quote, "gray lady" inaccurately represented Trump's comments. So much so, author and CNN contributor Joan Walsh canceled her subscription, tweeting, quote, "I can't keep rewarding such awful news judgment." And freshman Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez tweeted, "Let this front page serve as a reminder of how white supremacy is aided by and often relies upon the cowardice of mainstream institutions." Presidential hopefuls, Senators Kirsten Gillibrand tweeted, quote, "That's not what happened," and Cory Booker tweeted, quote, "Lives literally depend on you doing better, New York Times. Please do." And one word from Beto O'Rourke: unbelievable. Hours later, a second edition of the front page read, "Assailing hate, but not guns." And the website reflected a similar headline, "Trump condemns white supremacy, but stops short of major gun controls." Fox News is reporting that it is not clear if the headline change was in response to the backlash. The publication did not immediately respond to a request for comment.
They did not immediately respond to requests for comment. This is a philosophy that Professor McDaniel and I embrace.
Yes, indeed.
We do not immediately respond to requests for comments occasionally. So this plays into the discussion that we had earlier about, first of all, let's back up a sec. It's not just, in this case, Fox and right-wing media took what happened in this instance, which was apparently the New York Times changing a headline in response to pressure from the outside. They played this up as an example of media bias. That is to say, the New York Times, this is again according to people on the right, the New York Times basically caved in that members of the left, the left wing politically, were upset that the New York Times wasn't serving as a mouthpiece for the left-wing interpretation of political events, and they were outraged, and the New York Times buckled under this criticism. That's sort of the right-wing take on this. This sort of thing is not unprecedented, but it is unusual, and I think it's what's really fascinating in an era of Trump. A while back, a couple years ago, Professor McDaniel and I would teach this class, and we talk about media bias, and we would emphasize, and we do this a little bit in the lecture modules here, we would emphasize that the media have all sorts of biases, but partisan and ideological biases are down the list a little bit, right? The biases that are more evident are commercial biases, professional biases in the way they cover politics, the sources they rely on. You guys have seen this in our lecture modules. But it's getting kind of harder and harder for us to downplay the potential, the possibilities for ideological biases. And, certainly in an era of Trump, there have been questions raised about, can you even have objective journalism anymore? And there are outlets that traditionally have been, maybe a little left of center, but fairly mainstream, that have said they can no longer pretend that there are two sides to some of these issues. And they've come out sort of forcefully against Trump and, I guess, kind of by definition, the right wing in their coverage of media. I think that's, I'm not going to comment on the extent to which that's occurred or whether I think that's good or bad, except to say I think it's going to be difficult to pull back. I mean, once you kind of cross the Rubicon, as the Washington Post and CNN and the New York Times have done in their denunciations of Trump, it'll be kind of hard to pull back. Let's say in 2024, we have a race between, a mainstream Republican and a mainstream Democrat. Can you go back to being a neutral, credible news source under those circumstances? I don't know. Now, by the way, it's not just the right wing that's criticizing coverage these days. For those of you who were supporters of Bernie Sanders, Bernie Sanders has been forcefully going after the Washington Post lately. Sanders' argument is that because Sanders has been just crushing Amazon in his campaign rhetoric, and Jeff Bezos, I think it's Bezos, right?
Yeah.
I don't want to say Bezos, it's Bezos, is the owner of Amazon, also happens to own the Washington Post, Sanders feels and his supporters feel like he's been getting very, very bad coverage in the Democratic primary write-ups in the Washington Post, and he's drawing a causal connection point, right? That, because I'm going after Amazon, the Post is killing me. The Post has responded by saying this is ridiculous. Anybody who knows our political coverage knows that we don't do that. But so it's not just Fox News and the right wing criticizing the New York Times. It's also Sanders, and you'll see this with other Democratic candidates who don't get what they think is sort of fair coverage, will criticize the coverage they're getting from the mainstream media. What do Professor McDaniel and I have to say to help you kind of navigate through this? I wish we had better advice. I mean, I guess my statement would be to, broaden your search and to expose yourself to as many credible, don't ask me to define that these days, but credible news sources as possible. I think you guys will be able to have, you're probably pretty smart about this. You'll have a sense of, when you're getting a little bit of bias and when you're not. But the more you read, I think the better sense you'll have of these different situations. So, what do you think?
I think it's a slippery slope. And one of the things you've seen the media try to do is, well, they'll have kind of truth detector tests, like, okay, how truthful is this? Right. And that's kind of their way of the fact checking, things like that. And I think the problem with President Trump is because a lot of things that President Trump says are false, they have to, they've been put pressure on them to say, look, do not put his statement out there as if it's true. Say he falsely claims this. And there are a lot of mistakes that the media has made. So the classic example is during Hurricane Katrina. You had a picture of basically a white couple walking, and they were scavenging in a grocery store. Then you had two black women, and they were, say, looters, went through a grocery store. And so,
I think that's actually in our module.
Yeah.
I think that's actually something we talked
about.
And so
this is an example of, you know, of the way in which you paint or frame the story. I think, you know, the New York Times was in a weird situation where this was a horrific event. And in many ways, it was trying to say, look, you know, the president is trying to do something to help us heal with this event, and people just basically said no. People who thought the president contributed to this event were like, no, this is not true. This is not what happened. This is not what's going on.
Right. You know, in some sense, it gets to what Professor McDaniel and I talked about with episodic versus thematic frames. That what the Times did in its headline was absolutely correct in an episodic sense. Trump condemns, you know, white supremacy and racism. And not to put words in their mouth, but I think what Cory Booker and Beto O'Rourke and others were saying is, well, that may be true in episodic sense, but thematically, more broadly speaking, it's inaccurate to say Trump condemns racism. And so there's an interesting kind of divide there between the Times' attempt to cover something, which is factually correct. In the speech, Trump did explicitly condemn white supremacy. But thematically, their objection was that look at the environment he has helped create, right?
Yeah, you know? Again, because episodic is just like you're basically taking a frame. I think of a movie, you're taking one frame and looking at that, where the thematic is like, okay, what's the trend overall? So it's episodic would be talking about there was a shooting, where thematic would be like, well, there's a shooting, and here are the trends we've been seeing in regards to shootings.
Right.
And so, again, the episodic is much more common because it's an easier story to tell. And I think, you know, this was something where, okay, well, let's just get this out quickly, and it's easier to do when it's episodic, where thematic requires a good deal more research, and it requires you to tell a much larger and a little more complicated story. And so this is where you see this bias come into play, because sometimes, you know, people pay attention to the episodic more so than the thematic. And so you're going to see much more episodic frame being used, because that's what attracts viewers. It's also a little bit easier for reporters.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting, you know, I hadn't thought much about this until we opened up this conversation. I think there's a push at the Times and at the Post and other places to do more thematic coverage. I think their interpretation of Trump and the Trump administration is that it requires more thematic coverage. Everything is of a piece. But, you know, the more thematic you do, the more you do open yourselves up to questions about bias and interpretation, right? It's one thing to say, hey, you know, on Man Shack this morning at 5:30, there was a shooting, and, you know, the shooter answers to this description. Very few people are going to criticize your reporting along those lines. But if you say, as Professor McDaniel suggested, hey, that's the 25th shooting in South Austin this year, and it correlates with economic dislocation and a slowdown in hiring due to the tariffs. Okay, well, you know, that's thematic, but there are people who could say, well, wait a sec, why did you choose that, and are there other factors? So one of the interesting things about that Times headline is that it said, I think the compromise headline said, Trump condemns violence or racism, stop short of advocating stronger gun control. And you could, certainly make a case if you're, you know, pro Second Amendment rights, say, like, well, wait a sec, I mean, what, there are a lot of things he stopped short of here. Why would you pull that out? And that suggests a bias in the interpretation of the Times about what's the root cause of these things, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not commenting on it. I'm just saying, you know, the more thematic you do, I think the more you subject yourselves to criticisms over your particular frame, as Professor McDaniel was saying. So, at any rate, we love talking about media bias. And as we said, it's, you know, it's all over the place these days. You know, people on the right criticizing the way the media reported on the president's reaction to the shootings in Dayton and in El Paso. And on the left, there's criticisms that it wasn't forceful enough. And then there's all these Democratic candidates out there who were wondering why they're not getting attention, and why is Biden and Elizabeth Warren getting all of the publicity that, you know, also nobody's ever happy with media coverage, it seems. We're trying to kind of sift through and figure out what's legit and what's less so. Okay, so second issue, again, we always like to get a little public policy in here, although I guess that had some public policy aspects to it. An article caught my eye this morning about environmental protection laws in the United States. And in particular, the Trump administration announced that it was changing its interpretation, the criteria that they were going to use to judge endangered species classifications and actions pursuant to the Environmental Protection Act. Now, the Environmental Protection Act, maybe ironically, was passed under the Richard Nixon administration. Nixon was a funny guy. Not funny, ha-ha, but funny, odd. A lot of the environmental protections that you have today at the federal level were passed during the Nixon administration. Nixon was opened up China, negotiated strategic arms limitation treaties with the Soviet Union, actually had wage and price control during some economic hard times in the 1960s and 70s. For a guy who's associated as being kind of Mr. Republican in a lot of ways, Nixon has a lot of moderate to left-leaning legislation to his credit, I think. But the EPA was passed under the Nixon administration, and it's been bumping along now for, you know, what's that, 25 plus 20, almost 45 years at this point. And a couple of aspects to this took place. As I mentioned, the administration announced that it was adjusting the criteria it was using to review endangered species classifications. And what they particularly said, there were a bunch of things they said. One thing that caught my attention, I think it's gotten the most attention with respect to popular coverage of the issue, is that they were going to allow economic factors to be taken into consideration in the adjudication of whether a species ought to be protected or what sorts of protections ought to be allotted. Now, what does that mean? Well, I think what it means potentially is that if you're talking about, let's say, saying certain land could not be developed or could not be touched because there's a frog or a salamander or a bird or something like that in that territory, the economic impact on the local community might be a criteria that would be used to judge whether or not that was going to happen or not. That's my interpretation of what they're talking about there. I mentioned two things. So there's the broad rule. There's a specific aspect of this, though, that has also caught some attention. The Trump administration, prior to announcing these general changes, announced that they were going to reconsider a specific action in Alaska. There's a bay in Alaska there's up off the mountainside next to the bay, there's potential to do some mining. I think it's copper mining. And the copper mine application got dunked by the Environmental Protection Agency under the Environmental Protection Administration, under the Obama administration, because the environmental impact analysis said that if you did this on this mountainside, it was going to crush the bay's fish population, and it's an important salmon hatchery area, basically. It's a natural hatchery, but they said it was really going to have a detrimental effect on the salmon population, so they nuked it. They said, you can't do that. Trump had a meeting with the Alaskan governor, who's a Republican, who's pro-development, and then afterwards announced that they were going to reopen that case. And there were a lot of people who were asking, wait a sec, did Trump strike a deal with the governor? Did the administration basically tell the EPA to reopen this? And if so, is that appropriate? Right. So there's a specific episode in Alaska, but then there's the general announcement that also occurred, I think, on Monday of this week, where the administration said it was basically changing the criteria it was going to use for evaluation of endangered species more generally. Okay, so all of that's to say, interesting, Republican president comes in, says that federal regulation is something we're not maybe as hot on, that business is being kind of screwed here a little bit, so we're going to back off. How many people are surprised? Hold up your hands. I mean, isn't this what Republican administrations do? But this one has gotten some attention, and Professor McDaniel, he's more of a public health guy, but I'm sure he has some thoughts on, you know, our fish and fowl friends.
Oh, yeah. Again, anybody knows I'm a huge animal lover. but one of the things that's important to note is this has been a constant tug of war between protecting the environment and protecting the economy. And so there are a lot of people believe that as you increase environmental protections, you harm the economy. And as you expand the economy, you harm the environment. But there are a lot of people who say, like, no, actually environmental protections actually help the economy in the long term, that while you may not make a lot of money now, you spend less money later on due to environmental health concerns, things of that nature. But also what's important to note is that by loosening environmental policies to help one industry, you may actually be harming another industry. So Professor Shaw gave the example of the salmon hatchery. Well, guess what? This hurts fishermen, especially those who are trying to catch wild-caught salmon. We also have this problem right now in the Gulf of Mexico, where Texas and Louisiana shrimp farmers are having a problem with the loose environmental regulations that are further upstream on the Mississippi. So because of the pesticides or the fertilizer used in states like Illinois, Iowa, and others that leach into the Mississippi River, they come down and basically come down into the Gulf of Mexico and have created these zones where you actually have oxygen depletion in the water because of growing algae and the algae sucking up all the oxygen, to the point where fish are literally jumping out of the water in order to get some type of oxygen. And so it's creating these dead zones. And so while you were providing economic, loosening the protections to improve the economy at these upper states, the consequence of this is you're hurting the economy in these states further down. So it's one of these things where loosening these protections can help one certain business, but has been found to hurt another business. And it's important to kind of weigh this out, but then also there's this concern of whether or not strong environmental protections really do hurt the economy. That's a story that's commonly used, but the problem is there's no consistent evidence that strong environmental protections undermine the economy. People use that rhetoric a lot, but they don't have very strong evidence that actually exists.
Yeah, it's, look, you know, this is sort of a classic trade-off issue, and has been for years. And there are people who, as Professor McDaniel suggested, question whether, you know, the extent to which this is a direct trade-off, right? You know, there are people who argue that, you know, stronger environmental regulation will create economic opportunities. First of all, it's sort of a question of sustainability. But also, you know, as you put environmental regulations in place, you know, whether it's respect to fossil fuels, or it could create an opportunity to foster alternative energy industries and things like that. Now, you know, on the other hand, you look at places like, I read an article, I would recommend to y'all, if you get a chance, there's a wonderful article in The Economist, I think it's a month or so back, about California versus Texas, talking about two models for the future, the California model and the Texas model. And one of the things they talk about is, you know, the business environment that exists in those states. And the regulatory environment, it was interesting. There was a guy who says he does business in San Francisco and Havana. And he says it's actually easier for him to do business in Havana than it is in San Francisco. You know, Texas does have a reputation for being a very business-friendly environment, and lax environmental standards are one of those things that businesses like about Texas. You know, and it's interesting. In the article, it talks about how Texas could probably do with some additional environmental standards, but California, on the other hand, has really hemmed itself in with some of these regulations, and particularly with respect to land use and development. It's just so hard. You know, you talk about land issues in California. Anybody who's been to San Francisco or is, you know, at all familiar with San Francisco knows how, you know, you have a homeless problem in San Francisco, but their ability to do anything about it is really curtailed because you can't build anything out there. And it's not just because there's limited land. It's because doing anything requires all sorts of permissions and you know, regulatory sign-offs and things of that nature. So it's a fascinating issue. There's an interesting balance. I mean, the headline I saw, it had kind of a little focal point on the bald eagle and how some of these regulations could actually impinge upon the recovery of the bald eagle. And I won't get into it, but you know, this is interesting. I saw some other news commentary about this, talking about this guy in Mississippi who has some land he wanted to develop, and he was denied a permit to develop the land because there is an endangered frog, and the endangered frog is like 15 miles away, and it's in this swamp, and they decided that the habitat for the frog, that there are only a few places within like 100 miles that are sort of comparable habitats, and this guy, who's 15 miles away, has a similar habitat, and so they said, well, you can't develop that land on the off chance that the frog might migrate over. And this guy was just apoplectic. You know, I can't develop my land because of this fraud, you know. So, and you hear these stories all the time on both sides. You know, people who have the stories about the animals and, for instance, the salmon situation in Alaska, which seems pretty damning to the regulatory, to the opposition to regulation, right? Which is, I mean, you're stopping a copper mine that everybody agrees is going to have runoff that's going to crush this salmon habitat. That seems to be one that's kind of ridiculous. On the other hand, you have the Mississippi frog thing where a guy who's miles and miles away from the sort of, you know, ordinary looking frog is told that he can't develop his land. So we have some interesting stories kind of on both sides of the spectrum there. We don't plan to have or pretend to have solutions on all of this, but something you all need to be attentive to, because these debates are going to continue to develop. And there's this question of regulation versus personal liberty or personal freedom. It's driven American history, and it will continue to drive American history, and you all are going to be responsible for making good judgments on these sorts of things. So with that, let's pivot to our third story, which is a Texas-centered story. We like to talk a lot about Texas here. And this one's almost purely political, so we kind of like it. And I teased it up front by saying, now there is, as you all know at this point, hopefully, Texas has a state House of Representatives and a state Senate. House of Representatives is the lower house, 150 members. The Speaker of the House is a guy named Dennis Bonin. All right, Bonin is a Republican. He had his first term as Speaker. He replaced a gentleman named Joe Strauss. He had his first term as Speaker in the 2019 session that was just completed a couple of months ago. By almost everyone's account, it was a pretty productive session. You know, Professor McDaniel and I have talked to people just to make sure we're on firm ground in asserting this. You know, they managed to get, you know, a budget that people were fairly happy with, increased funding to education, both at the K through 12 and at the higher ed level. They seemed to address some issues and not get bogged down into fights over bathrooms and, you know, late-term abortions and the kind of stuff that has dominated the sessions previously. Now, Bonin is considered a moderate Republican, though. And so the conservative wing of the Republican Party isn't really thrilled with him, even though they went along for the most part with him, his ascension to the Speaker position. Now, so why are we talking about this after the session's over? Well, Mr. Bonin, you know, Professor McDaniel and I like to, there's a phrase or a word we want you all to be aware of. It's our word of the day. It's called hubris. Hubris, cruel hubris, as Homer Simpson once said. Bonin, on the heels of this very good session, apparently went to an individual who is named Michael Quinn Sullivan. Michael Quinn Sullivan runs an organization called Empower Texas. Empower Texas is a very conservative association. You know, they have a newsletter. They basically, you know, campaign heavily for conservative issue positions within Texas state politics. They endorse candidates. They kind of, you know, will take pot shots at candidates that they think aren't sufficiently conservative. It is ostensibly a news or an information organization. Now, at the state Senate level, their reporters with Empower Texas have been given access to the floor so they can do reporting during the session. In the House, they were denied credentials. All right, so Empower Texas couldn't get any of its reporters on the House floor. And Bonin called in Michael Quinn Sullivan, leader of Empower Texas, and said, I tell you what, we will, this is allegedly, although allegedly meaning there's tape of this, but he said, we will give your reporters access to the floor during the next session if you help me go after these 10 Republicans who were kind of a pain in the neck in the last session. Now, this is a weird bargain to seek to strike. First of all, you know, Bonin, as mentioned, is sort of a moderate. He's never been a darling of the conservatives. Michael Quinn Sullivan is sort of a kingmaker amongst the conservatives. To reach out like this with a deal that if anybody got wind of it would be really problematic for the speaker seems very odd. It's also odd because the 10 legislators, the 10 Republican representatives that Bonin was talking about were amongst the most conservative. These are people you would think Quinn Sullivan would like. Now, what apparently Bonin thought was that these 10 Republicans had worked with the Democrats to undermine legislation in the last session. The Democrats didn't like it because they're Democrats and didn't like the Republican legislation. The Republicans didn't like it because it wasn't sufficiently conservative. That's why there was this weird alliance between the Democrats and the Republicans. So Bonin, apparently feeling his oats, thought, well, I'm going to go after these guys. I'm going to work with Quinn Sullivan, who won't like him because they work with the Democrats, I guess. Well, Quinn Sullivan, upon, you know, leaving the meeting, announced that, hey, I just had a meeting with the Speaker, and he's got a list of 10 Republicans he's targeting in the next election cycle. Michael Quinn Sullivan, or Bonin's office, said, didn't deny the meeting, didn't deny they were going after people, said there was no list. Well, that's, you know, we're all adults here. We've all probably engaged in a statement of this sort. It's not exactly a lie, but it's like, well, you're not denying much of anything except the explicit existence of a list. So Michael Quinn Sullivan, who had, of course, taped the meeting on his phone, allowed some Republicans in the House to listen to the tape, and they basically came out saying, yeah, he had the meeting. It went down basically exactly as Michael Quinn Sullivan said, and there is, in fact, a list. So now Speaker Bonin, triumphant off of his legislative session, is in a lot of trouble. Last I read, I think it was this morning in the Texas Tribune, they've turned the matter over to the Texas Rangers. I tell you, I've been in Texas now for 25 years. I'm not exactly sure when and where the Texas Rangers have jurisdiction. I'm always kind of pleased when they do. But they've turned this case over to the Texas Rangers. It sounds like Bonin might have serious trouble retaining his speakership next time around. So, at any rate, that's the setup. Professor McDaniel, thoughts, comments on this?
One term as Speaker. And, I mean, it was... I mean, again, if we go and talk about media bias, this is clearly an attempt to provide some type of incentive for a media outlet to go after a certain number of individuals. The Speaker overplayed his hand. It was a really stupid decision. I don't really know what else to say. Yeah. It's pretty much over for him. And now people have thought like, oh, well, this leaves an opening for Democrats. I don't think so. I think if anything, the Republicans will take control, and what will happen is the new Speaker will probably be more in line with the conservatives, with the more hardline conservatives there, because they're going to be in uproar saying, okay, the moderates are out to get us, and in order to appease them, they'll probably put someone who's closer to them in as Speaker. So this was really, looks like it'll work out to be more of a win for the conservatives. You had one term, Chief. You did well. Flew too close to the sun.
That's right. That's right. You know, what's the line? I remember the line from, I was quoting Homer, I think it was a line from one of the Simpsons where, he's actually playing one of the Halloween episodes, playing in a board game, and he's in Candyland, he's climbing the ladder, or shoots in ladders, he's going, riding high, and then sinking low. It's like, oh, cruel hubris. You know, there is a question, why would you do this? I mean, what exactly made you think that someone who basically thinks that you're too moderate and would much prefer another speaker, I would assume, is going to work with you on this? It's very odd. We don't have any broad kind of macro lessons here. It's more of kind of a factual thing about what's going on in Texas politics. I do think, all right, so if we're talking more mechanically about what happens, if the 150-person House, if the returns come in after the 2020 election, and let's say the Democrats are within 5 to 10 seats of a majority, so the Republicans are still the majority, but it's a small majority, is it possible that someone like Bonin, a moderate Republican, could have the support of the Democrats and half a dozen or 10 Republicans, they would all vote for this person to make him or her Speaker, so you'd have kind of a moderate Republican as the Speaker? I suppose that's possible. I suppose it's possible Bonin could do that. But someone like that is not going to have the support of the conservative Republicans. And what's more likely, as Professor McDaniel said, is that the conservatives figure out a consensus candidate and the moderate Republicans vote for that person. So the coalition would be moderate and conservative Republicans as opposed to moderate Republican and the Democrats. Because what you need, of course, is a majority in order to become Speaker. You don't have to have, the Speaker of the House does not have to be a member of the majority party. The Speaker of the House simply has to have a majority of votes within the House of Representatives, right? So that's just, I guess that's our technical point of the day. Beyond that, it's just a lesson to all of us, you know. You got to be a little careful, right? What's the catfish hunter line? You know, the sun don't shine on the same dog's butt every day.
That's right.
So, if you have a couple good days, you know, keep it in your hip pocket and be happy, but always have your head on a swivel, as we used to say. Yeah.
Yes.
All right. With that, that's our last in the news segment. Got anything else?
Oh, no, that's it for me.
All right. That's good. All right. We'll see you all soon. Come to office hours if you want to get some additional information, and stay cool.